Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The FBI and Apple squaring off again today in congressional hearings. Their fight over access to an iPhone left behind in the San Bernardino mass shooting. The government wants that phone unlocked and has a federal court order saying do it. Apple refusing, saying big issues of encryption and privacy are at stake. Apple CEO saying the government is trying to force Apple to write the software equivalent of cancer. The FBI says we need it. This hour on Point, the former head of the NSA, CIA, and more on the Apple FBI standoff. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Where are you coming down on this battle? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear advocates for all sides today, including we'll hear from General Michael Hayden, former director of the NSA and of the CIA. His position may surprise you. He's out with a new book, Playing to the Edge. Joining me first today from Oakland, California's Kim Zetter. She's senior staff reporter at Wired, covering cybercrime, privacy, security. You can link to her coverage of this whole Apple FBI showdown over end-to-end encryption and more at our website, onpointradio.org. Kim Zetter, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Where's the phone?
The phone right now is still in possession of the FBI.
Okay. And as the court dropped its order, where does the court stand? Where does Apple stand? What's the exact state of affairs?
The state of affairs is that Apple has responded to the motion by the government to force. I guess I should start for a week ago. Government files a motion to force Apple to help them crack this iPhone. The court actually issues the order and tells Apple that they should comply, but also gives Apple 5 days to respond and explain why it shouldn't have to comply. Apple did respond last week, and now it sits sort of in limbo until a hearing that will occur on March 22nd. The judge will hear oral arguments in California and then issue her ruling in that case.
We've got today, before the House Judiciary Committee, you've got the FBI Director James Comey testifying again, as well as the top lawyer at Apple, their general counsel, Bruce Sewell. Let's just get a little feeling for what the main players here have been saying. Here was Comey testifying last week before the House Intelligence Committee.
The San Bernardino litigation is not about us trying to send a message or establish some precedent. It really isn't. It's about trying to be competent in investigating something that is an active investigation.
The FBI chief, we're just trying to do our job. But talking with NPR's Morning Edition last week, Apple attorney, outside, I guess, counsel, Ted Olson, big lawyer, said, look, they're asking for a lot more than just cooperation.
What in the law requires us to redesign the iPhone, to rewrite code, to provide an Achilles heel in the iPhone? It was designed to protect the secrecy and privacy of individuals who use the iPhone. Mm-hmm. It was people wanted to be able to trust their personal information to the iPhone. It was designed in such a way to prevent this sort of backdoor that the government is seeking.
So bringing up a kind of First Amendment freedom of speech foundation for an argument there. And then, of course, Tim Cook himself with that kind of almost incendiary cancer clip.
The only way to get information, at least currently, the only way we know, would be to write a piece of software that we view as sort of the software equivalent of cancer.
Kim Zetter, what is Tim Cook talking about when he talks about the software equivalent of cancer?
So in order to get into a late version operating system of the iPhone, and that is any version after version 8, okay. Apple can't undermine the password that users use to lock the phone. The only way to get into this phone is to write a new version of its operating system that essentially eliminates some security protections that they've built into that later version of software. And once those security protections are removed, then the FBI will be able to conduct what's called a brute force password attack. That is, sending thousands of password guesses at the phone per second until they guess the correct password and unlock the phone on their own.
But a software equivalent of cancer suggests that if they comply in this case, they will be undermining encryption across a, it suggests to me, across a wide spectrum of currently locked devices. Is that the case?
Yes. I mean, the FBI, the Justice Department asserts that this is just about one phone. Apple is asserting, no, this is about hundreds of thousands of phones, potentially, not just in the U.S., but if the precedent is set here, forcing Apple to create this software, then law enforcement agencies around the world will ask the same thing of Apple.
What's the argument that you see emerging? We may hear it or have heard it from their general counsel today, that Ted Olson is appearing to mount here. When he says they're asking us to rewrite our product, is that a First Amendment appeal in the making?
It has an element of First Amendment, and I know that that sounds pretty odd, but here's the argument. In order to install this software on the San Bernardino phone, Apple has to sign the firmware that it's going to create. And signing that firmware with its digital key asserts that this is software that Apple supports and that Apple believes is secure to run on this phone. And Apple says that that's sort of antithetical to what it actually believes. It doesn't want to write this software, and writing this software without security protections in it undermines and undoes the security that it spent years developing for its phones. So it's asserting this First Amendment argument that in forcing it to write this software and give it to a phone and then also to sign it with its digital signature, which gives it, you know, the Apple stamp of approval, it's forcing Apple to assert something, compel speech in the legal sense, that it doesn't want to assert.
Now, we've heard just in recent days, Kim, that Apple is moving forward on a next-generation smartphone that would be unopenable. Would that make this whole debate moot?
Well, that is the logical next step. It's very funny, you know. this is essentially the Justice Department pointing out a bug, a vulnerability in Apple's current system. Apple is saying, thanks for pointing that out. Now we're just going to fix it next. That it does escalate.
So they couldn't, even if they wanted to open it. Is that doable, and are they on that path?
They are on that path. So right now they can't unlock the phone, but like I said, they could create this software. And they're aiming for their next version to create a version that they would no longer be able to write a firmware update for. And that would likely involve requiring the phone to require a password in order to upload any firmware. And that would mean that Apple would be prohibited from adding any kind of new firmware, such as the one that the FBI wants them to add to this phone.
Bill Gates has seemed to come down on the government side in this one, Mark Zuckerberg on Apple's side. What's your sense of the industry overall? Where is their support going?
The industry overall is really strongly in the field on the side of Apple.
Why?
Because this isn't just about Apple. If Apple is forced to do this, all companies, this will spread. The All Writs Act is the act that the government is using to force Apple to comply in here. It's a very vaguely written act that calls on third parties to provide technical assistance to the government. And if the courts interpret this act in the way that the government wants, that opens all technology companies to the same kinds of demands.
Is it primarily about principle or about profit? They're afraid that if end-to-end encryption isn't allowed, if privacy's in question, their sales will decline here and maybe abroad as well.
Well, I think they're intertwined. I mean, Apple's business is predicated on the security of its product, and if you're asking them to undermine that security, to undermine the assurance that they've given customers, then you are undermining, you know, its marketability, let's say. And also, in forcing U.S. companies to do this really puts them at a disadvantage in the market compared to other companies overseas that won't have the same demands on them.
Kim Zetter with Wired, you are terrific, and we are very grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks for taking a minute to join us.
My pleasure.
Kim Zetter, senior staff reporter at Wired. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from San Francisco, General Michael Hayden, who's the former director of the National Security Agency, NSA, 1999 to 2005, of the CIA from 2006 to 2009, retired Air Force four-star general. He's author of the new book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. He now works at the Chertoff Group, the private security consultancy. General Hayden, Michael Hayden, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for the chance to chat, Tom. Thank you.
We kind of thought that you, of all people, having headed the NSA and headed the CIA, might be standing shoulder to shoulder with James Comey at the FBI right now saying, open that phone. But I understand that you are not. Why not?
Well, first of all, Director Comey's got a very good point, and if I were sitting in Director Comey's chair looking through his lens, I might have his point of view, but I'm not, and I don't. And Kim laid this out very well with all the issues involved here. I mean, there are constitutional questions as to whether Apple can be compelled. There are privacy questions with regard to, you know, what the government can and can't see. Tom, I'm not arguing any of those points, which are very important points, but they're not mine today.
Okay.
Mine is a security question. And frankly, I think American security is better provided by not allowing the government to have exceptional or extraordinary access to otherwise unbreakable devices.
Why, in a nutshell? We've got to take a break. We'll explore it after the break. But in 30 seconds, why?
Yeah, I was a director of NSA. When somebody pushed a door or a window into a wall of otherwise unbreakable encryption, my odds of breaking in get real high.
I don't know your business well enough to understand what you mean by that, General.
Look, breaking through a wall of heavy encryption is very difficult, sometimes impossible. Mm-hmm. If you create a doorway, a pathway to allow the government to get through, that doorway and pathway will attract bad actors to try to get through there as well.
So you're saying leave it alone because if the FBI gets in there, bad actors will get in there as well, and overall U.S. security generically will be diminished?
That's exactly right.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the standoff between Apple and the FBI over smartphone encryption and privacy, law enforcement, asking who's right and where we will ultimately draw the line here. My guest right now, General Michael Hayden, headed up the NSA, headed up the CIA until 2009, author of the new book Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Apple says they're going to make a phone that's impossible to crack. Is that the right way to go? Should the government have some access by warrant to a locked phone, to this locked phone out of San Bernardino? How do you see the big issues here? Michael Hayden was in charge, tip-top charge of tip-top American security agencies, and he says, no, James Comey, don't push too hard on this. And General Hayden, there in San Francisco, you're saying that this is about unbreakable end-to-end encryption, and I guess you really mean unbreakable, that would not be broken for a warrant, because it couldn't technically be. And you're saying that's good for the United States. As a law enforcement guy or a security guy yourself, why again?
Sure. Number one, imagine, if you will, Tom, unbreakable encryption as a wall. All right? When the government wants exceptional or extraordinary access, mm-hmm. what they're asking Apple and other companies to do is to create a door, a window, or something, or an access point. And, you know, just kind of yep. extending the metaphor, Tom, a door, even with really good locks, isn't a wall. It's a weak point that allows other people to try to exploit it. And again, back to my point, when I'm talking about American security, I actually think the stronger we can make that wall with regard to encryption, the better we will be, even if it prevents the government in cases, justifiable cases, with a warrant, perfectly under law, to do that, because it creates the condition I just described. Tom, the last 3 years, Jim Clapper, who is our Director of National Intelligence,
yeah.
has, in his worldwide threat briefing, told Congress the single greatest threat to the United States now is the cyber threat. Why would you weaken your defenses against the cyber threat, even in the name of absolutely legitimate requirements over here with regard to fighting crime or fighting terrorism?
So do you see, Michael Hayden, do you see unbreakable end-to-end encryption coming, and you're saying this is just the future and law enforcement's going to have to figure out how to deal with it?
I actually think it will be much more difficult in the future for law enforcement to do some of the things they have done in the past. But Tom, Let me step back from this timeline a little bit.
Okay.
What law enforcement's been able to do over the last 10 or 15 years may not be the norm. It may be the exception. The last 10 to 15 years, it's all of us have rushed into the cyber domain and put things we used to keep in a safe into our smartphones.
Yep.
That's created a tremendous electronic environment for law enforcement and, frankly, for intelligence.
Yeah.
But I can't claim that's the norm. I mean, because prior to that, law enforcement and intelligence didn't have that field to harvest. We may actually be returning to that pre, so to speak, gold rush days that we had for the last 10 to 15 years, and both intelligence and law enforcement are going to have to go back to some of the old, more traditional approaches.
But does this mean that the cyber realm becomes a closed playground for criminals, for terrorists, and the FBI, the CIA, the NSA cannot get in there and see what's going on?
Well, actually, life is full of difficult trade-offs, and that's the underlying theme in the book that you mentioned that I've just written, Tom, that this is all an ocean of gray, and you're making very difficult choices. Now, look, you know, I've actually talked to Apple about this, and you, as you might expect, this is months ago now.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually surprised, like you, and pleased with my position. And then I said, yeah, guys, but before you start tearing the goalposts down here and celebrating, let me tell you what I would do as the director of NSA as soon as I hung up with you guys.
Okay.
I'd call Congress and the White House and say, now I'm going to need about $500 million more dollars because I want to be able to break that encryption, you know, the old-fashioned way. All right, through intelligence methods and sources. What I am worried about is that we build into the Apple and other devices a mechanism that makes that easier to do for everyone.
I mean, this is so interesting. I mean, it's kind of ironic because, I mean, essentially, as I understand it, you're the guy who built the metadata system that Edward Snowden laid out for the public later. You were very aggressive, as you say, in looking for technical solutions to these challenges. But you want to ratchet up the technical challenge, not down, by Apple opening this, what, so that only super advanced American technology has a chance in security service hands of getting in there?
Tom, think of it this way. In both instances, what I was interested in within law to provide the most security I could for the American people. And in this case, I actually think the answer to most security, the strongest security, is the unbreakable end-to-end encryption, even though it makes other things more difficult.
General Hayden, stand by. There is some rich irony here in Michael Hayden's new book, Playing to the Edge. He's talking about playing so close to the line in terms of law and oversight that you get chalk dust on your cleats. But in this case of Apple and the FBI, he's saying, nope, let them have that end-to-end encryption. It's better overall for American security. Michael Hayden, please stand by there in San Francisco. James Lewis joins us right now as well from Washington, Senior Fellow, Director of the Strategic Technologies Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, writes on cybersecurity, encryption, warfare. James Lewis, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. You hear the former head of the NSA and CIA saying, let Apple have its encryption here. Don't bust it down with a court order. It's been a happy sort of paradise for 10 or 15 years for security and law enforcement playing around here, but now is not the time to put a crack in the wall. You don't agree. Why?
Oh, I don't know if I disagree. And hi, Mike.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
Good. You know, we made a decision, the U.S. made a decision in 1999 about risk, that the benefits of letting people have access to strong encryption outweighed the cost to law enforcement and to intelligence agencies. And we have to reconsider that risk because it's a very different world. So I don't know where we're going to come out. It's a political decision. It's a very noisy debate, not a particularly honest one, to tell you the truth. It's also not an American debate anymore. And so one of the cardinal rules here that just if you're going to jerk people's chain a little bit would be that companies should treat the FBI the same way they treat China. Right. But it's a global debate about risk and about privacy and about data protection because people don't have any privacy anymore. And I'm not sure they like that.
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying Apple lays its phone open for China, but not for the FBI?
Well, we don't know, because Apple has come to a number of agreements with China that have not been made public. In one, they adjusted an operating system to accommodate Chinese security concerns. In another, they moved their data centers for iCloud into China for Chinese customers and possibly for others. So they've been very accommodating with the Chinese. And, you know, that's one of the ironies in this case, in that we're now talking about a global market. It's not 1999, where most users of the internet were American. It's a global market, and that global market is mad both at NSA, but they're worried about FBI. But they're also mad at American companies because of what they do with their data.
Michael Hayden, would you demand parity from Apple? Whatever they do for China, they have to do for the U.S., for the FBI. Is there already a crack in that wall you describe in China?
Well, look, if Apple's taking a principled as opposed to a commercial position, then they have to stand by their principles, and I would expect them to do that. And to the degree they don't do that, and Jim raises some very good questions, to the degree they don't do that, we have a right to demand answers. But Jim brings up a wonderful point. If we do this, if we legislate this, or if the court decides this, and we have this exceptional access for the U.S. government, you need to play this game out 3 and 4 moves down the board. What then do we expect Apple to do when they're approached by the Chinese, Russian, Saudi Arabian, or Iranian government, who for their own legitimate law enforcement purposes, according to their own lights, expect Apple to do the same thing for them? As Jim points out, this is a truly global issue now.
Let's get our listeners in, if I may. Waterford, Pennsylvania. Dolores is calling. Hi, Dolores. You're on the air with the former head of the NSA and CIA and James Lewis. Welcome.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, sir. I have a couple points. Now, I guess I'm on the side of the FBI, but I also understand what General Hayden is saying about encryption. And I think, sir, in years past, there have been some successes by foreign intelligence services in hacking encrypted devices in DOD. But, you know, we have a lot of people out there working very hard to protect the public. But at the same time, we have a lot of people out there putting all types of their private information for everybody to see. And I guess my question is, the next time that there's an incident in this country, who's going to get the blame? Is it going to be the government again and the intelligence community? You know, so who wins here? Is it the terrorists, the drug cartels, the scammers? I mean, I understand this is a very complicated situation, and, you know, there really isn't an easy answer to any of this.
Dolores, you're right on top of it, but let me put that question to both my guests. Nate Cardozo joins us in from just a moment as well from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Michael Hayden, you've been in the hot seat. If something really bad came down the pike and afterward, you know, the report was, well, if the FBI had been able to get in there, we could have avoided this. Whose neck is on the block?
Sure, and obviously public response to those kinds of things isn't always rational or wise. There's a lot of emotion involved in it.
Yeah.
Jim just said a few minutes ago, this is about balancing risk, not preventing risk. And right now, you ask my judgment, even as the former NSA guy, in terms of balancing risk, I believe America is a safer nation with the best possible encryption, and that is degraded when you give anyone, even our government, exceptional access that allows them to, in one way or another, get behind the wall and
James,
see the unencrypted information.
James, would you agree with that, that net-net we're better off leaving this Apple encryption intact?
I think we have to walk through that. I mean, I was laughing while you were talking because, you know, and don't take this the wrong way, Mike, but General Hayden had kind of a different position in 1999 and 2000.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and I was on the other side then, and so now I still think that letting people have access to strong encryption is the right answer. If there had been encryption at OPM, the Chinese wouldn't be reading my personnel files. But is there a way that we can do this that accommodates as much as possible legitimate concerns for law enforcement? And that's the challenge before us, a decision about risk and a question about what sort of technology best serves the broad public interest.
Let me get one more voice right here with us. Nate Cardozo joins us, staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. It's a digital civil liberties team. They've been very strong in defending Apple on this. Nate Cardozo in San Francisco as well. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So you've got the former head of the NSA and CIA, Michael Hayden, with us saying, Let it be. Don't crack that wall of encryption. You know, some ironies there, given his position maybe when he was head of those agencies. But as you listen, he says we're better off without it in security terms. Is this a matter of security in your mind or principle, constitutional principle?
It's absolutely both. And it pains me to say this, but General Hayden's right. You know, every computer scientist, every mathematician, every cryptographer that has looked at the question has said, you can't give the FBI what it's asking for here without endangering the security of all of us. And that said, the reason that FBI is asking for this from Apple isn't for the data that's on this phone. They want the legal precedent to be able to order companies to redesign their systems at their whim. And that's not something that our Constitution allows. So Hayden's right. This endangers all of our security, as well as, frankly, endangering our American companies' constitutional rights to innovate as they see fit.
Are you confident that your view would win out in the American courts, maybe in the U.S. Supreme Court, Nate?
Well, see, I'm not exactly sure this is going to get to the Supreme Court. There are a lot of prerequisites, but my organization, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is filing an amicus brief, which we think lays bare the First Amendment arguments here, and that'll be on file later in the week.
Michael Hayden, you're suggesting let Apple have its wall, but then get another, I think you said $500 million or one of those big numbers that goes into security, and have the NSA and CIA go to work on figuring out some new way to get around that wall. Are you confident that if you were at the head of the NSA or CIA today, given the money and given a little time, you could get around this?
No, not at all. But Tom, I mean, intelligence, law enforcement, even electronic intelligence, electronic surveillance is made up of many parts. You know, Jim Lewis and I lived this plotline in the mid-1990s with something called Clipper Chip.
The Clipper Chip, yeah.
And then Director of NSA, Mike McConnell, was making the same kinds of arguments that Director Comey is making today, and Mike lost the argument. I mean, we didn't bake in access in the silicon that allowed NSA to break through encryption. And Mike McConnell, one of my predecessors at NSA, then tells the story, and thus began the greatest decade and a half in the history of electronic surveillance. When you think, Tom, beyond the content of communications, all of us leave such extensive digital exhaust out there that there are other tools that law enforcement and intelligence can use, even if they don't ever get access to the actual content of a communication. And again, when you play this several moves down the board, step back and think of what we're thinking about here.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to legislate or have a court rule to outlaw technological progress. And I don't think that's a winning hand. And even if you can make that happen in America, as Jim points out, this is a global enterprise now. Other companies will do this. And frankly, American intelligence and American law enforcement will suffer in the long term if high-end encryption is driven offshore and is now in the possession of developed by foreign powers.
Michael Hayden, I'm going to take this to Nate Cardozo and James Lewis after we let you go in just a second here, but I have to ask you, while you're here at Super Tuesday, after all, and I'm reading here you telling Bill Maher a day or two ago that if Donald Trump wins the presidency, and Donald, who has said that torture works and that he would use torture, he would do torture worse than waterboarding, much worse, much stronger, that the U.S. military might refuse that order and that would be justified in your view.
Well, there are two things that the candidate said that I object to. One is I'd waterboard and a lot more because they deserve it. Now, look, I was head of CIA. We used enhanced interrogation techniques, but we didn't do it because they deserved it. We are not American justice. We are American intelligence. We did it not rearward-looking but forward-looking. We needed to get information to protect Americans. And the other thing the candidate said was that he would put terrorist families at risk as part of his war-winning strategy against ISIS and like organizations. That's actually inconsistent with the laws of armed conflict and the ethic of the American Armed Forces, and I fully expect that the American Armed Forces would not perform that action.
Americans, put that in your pipe and smoke it on Super Tuesday. General Michael Hayden is author of the new book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. Joined us from San Francisco. Michael Hayden, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the standoff between Apple and the FBI over smartphone encryption and privacy and law enforcement, asking who's right and where we will ultimately draw the line here, where we should draw the line. James Lewis is with us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's all over cybersecurity there. Joins us from Washington. Nate Cardozo is with us from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Civil Liberties Team in San Francisco. You can join us today. What do you think? Should the government have some access by warrant to a locked phone? Will American high tech suffer if the world sees Apple open the door? Can we have effective law enforcement in a world of end-to-end encryption all over? We just heard General Michael Hayden, former head of the NSA and CIA, say, well, yes, on balance, we're better off with unbreakable end-to-end encryption as the rule rather than the exception. James Comey, in testimony last week on Capitol Hill, saying, look, we just went into this phone. This isn't about everything under the sun. Just let us into this phone. Here's Comey.
The code the judge has directed Apple to write works only on this one phone. And so the idea of it getting out in the wild and working on my phone or your phone, at least the experts tell me, is not a real thing. And the second thing, is that the code will be at Apple, which is, I think, done a pretty darn good job of protecting its code.
Apple CEO Tim Cook, next day on ABC, this is not about one phone.
This case is not about one phone. This case is about the future. What is at stake here is, can the government compel Apple to write software that we believe would make hundreds of millions of customers vulnerable around the world, including the U.S., and also trample civil liberties that are at the basic foundation of what this country was made on?
Apple CEO Tim Cook right there. Full disclosure, my son works at Apple. Nothing to do with the encryption operations there. Nevertheless, James Lewis, Nate Cardozo, let's take a couple of calls and then we'll dive into it with the two of you. Detroit, Michigan, Ricky is calling. Ricky, what do you think?
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. What do you see here, Ricky?
I'd like to make a comment. The first one I would like to say is I think the general is 100% of what he's saying. I agree with him. You know, we can't allow this. We can't.
Can't allow what, Ricky?
We cannot allow the government or law enforcement or anyone to be able to go into our personal for any reason.
Even when a crime is committed and 14 people are dead.
Listen, you know, just like the general said, I'm sure the government can create something to break into that personal phone. You know, let's go at it like that way. You know, let's go at it that way. Just like 100 million people, just here in Michigan alone, there's so many people who have so much information on their phone.
Mm-hmm.
And every day we have to go through the situation of someone breaking in and trying to get our code. Just going through that. Now all of a sudden we got to worry about what? Law enforcement, you know, going through our phone, finding what? What are you looking for? You know, I mean, if the FBI can do this, let's not forget, all it takes is some senator, you know, or some congressman, or whomever, to get what, information on someone else's information that they're trying to keep from getting out.
Ricky, we've got it. It's that essential American instinct to preserve privacy, and more than instinct, it's in the Constitution, and I appreciate your call right there. Let me hold that. Get one or two more here. John in Milford, New Hampshire. John, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I just had to comment that I believe the whole privacy argument is a red herring, because if the government can issue a legitimate warrant that can search your home, your office, your paper files, your safe. What if they have a really strong safe? Can they not break into that safe? What makes data on a phone different from data in a file cabinet? Why is the data on a phone so sacrosanct?
What about the General Michael Hayden's argument that it's been a playground for a decade or two, but that's too much, too easy access if you allow it, and you know, it actually ends up reducing our net security.
It seems to me that his talk about end-to-end encryption should apply to government databases, whatever.
Yep.
But to a phone, to my private phone. Why is the data on my phone holier than the data in my file cabinet at home, which the government can get anytime they want with a warrant?
We'll pick it straight up. Nate Cardozo, let me bring that one to you. The government can come with a warrant and say, open that safe, so why not open that phone?
Well, the data on your phone is no different than the data in your file cabinet or the data in your safe. The government can absolutely get a warrant, and we think that they absolutely should be able to get a warrant to look at the data in your phone, in your email, if that warrant is based on probable cause. But that's not what the warrant did here. That's not what the order that's at issue in San Bernardino
is. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is, back in the physical world, the FBI could get a warrant to break into a safe and to search that safe. But they could not get an order to force Brinks to make a master key for the safe. And that's what the order here does, right? This phone is in the hands of the FBI at Quantico. It's not in the hands of the NSA at Fort Meade. And we know for a certainty that the best hackers in the world, the people most able to break into this phone, aren't at Quantico. They're at Fort Meade.
Yeah, but wait a minute. If the only way to get into this phone is to do what you call making a master key, isn't it?
No. So that's the only way that Apple can get into the phone.
Yeah.
The NSA has been completely silent here. I don't believe John McAfee when he says it, but I do believe others when they say it, that it's only a matter of time before a skilled hacker could break into this phone.
Yeah, but that's a different deal. Our caller from New Hampshire says, keep this within the ambit of the law and law enforcement
exactly
and say, open this phone the same way that you would open that safe or that file cabinet. Open it.
And that's exactly the point. My goal and the Electronic Frontier Foundation's goal is to keep it exactly the same way. Back in the physical
doesn't
world,
sound like
said,
it. You just said have the NSA
all,
figure out some workaround outside the law.
But no, absolutely not. A search warrant could authorize the NSA to attempt to break into the phone,
okay,
just like in the physical world, a search warrant authorized the FBI to break into a safe. No search warrant ever issued to order Brinks to produce that master key. And that's what we're dealing with here.
What if I'm the homeowner and the suspect, the FBI can't say, pull out your key and open this safe?
Nope. The Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination makes it so that you cannot order a suspect to unlock with a physical key, maybe you could, but with a combination lock safe, you cannot order a suspect to open it. That has never been the law in the United States.
James Lewis, do you accept this interpretation of the law and what's going on here, and that makes this phone fundamentally different?
Well, it's kind of like gun control in a way, in that we have to figure out the balance between private rights and social responsibility. And the rules that were developed in the 1970s, including the rule that says NSA is limited in its ability to help FBI, maybe we need to reconsider them. There's a lot of moving parts here, and Apple is just one of them. This is the mm-hmm. opening skirmish in a long fight over data protection and the failure of privacy policy.
So the warrant for a home file cabinet analogy, does that ring right to you? Is it the same? Do you agree with Nate Cardozo when he says you can't ask Apple to – they're the equivalent of the Brinks truck company coming to the safe and opening it with a master key, and that's not constitutional to demand?
Well, the Constitution says that the court gets to decide what is a reasonable search. And in this case, a court decided that it was reasonable. They issued a warrant. Apple should service the warrant or try to vacate it. And they're in an awkward spot because this is in some ways a global marketing ploy that blew up on them. Apple needs after Snowden to reassure the world that they're not going to let the U.S. just stroll in and take data. And they got maneuvered into a very bad case for them. But if they don't like this warrant, go back to the court. And they're thinking about doing that. But of course, you can have a lot of fun imagining if Apple had to disclose everything it does. We don't know. Maybe they can already do this, in which case, it's going to be a very messy case. I wish in some ways this wasn't the case we were having this debate on. I wish Apple had just sort of quietly gone along with it. It's not going to affect the Chinese and the Russians. Somebody said that, and it's just not right.
Not
they've
affect them in what way?
They've already asked Apple to comply with their security concerns, so we're the ones behind the curve.
But are you saying Apple is doing exactly for the Chinese and Russians what they won't do for the FBI or something else, or do you even know?
We don't know because all we know is that Apple, and Tim Cook tweeted this, that Apple was the first company to comply with Chinese security regulations, and they've done some other things. So what are they doing in China? I don't know, but it's an important market for them, and I don't think the Chinese government would put up with this kind of stuff. So well, we put it in the global context.
Nate? Yeah. Sorry, Nate?
No, we don't know.
Yeah. Well, actually, we do. We can verify that the firmware images that ship in China are identical to the ones here. What Apple did in China was that they moved iCloud over there. And, of course, Apple does turn over iCloud data to the FBI, so that is no different. And the general counsel of Apple said without qualification that no other country in the world had asked Apple to do what the FBI is asking it to do here. And of course, Jim, when you say what Apple should do is go to the court and fight the warrant, that's exactly what they did. That's what their motion to vacate that they filed last Friday or last Thursday was.
It took them a while, and you know the thing that I think is funny is right after Apple agreed to meet Chinese security concerns, there was a major hack from the Chinese government into Chinese customers of Apple. Just a coincidence, I'm sure.
Millie in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Millie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. My thing is this information that the FBI is trying to get is information that's going to be helpful probably to keep the United States safe. And I don't understand how a company cannot oblige by the, you know, the FBI rules or the court ruling and keeping this phone tied up when it could probably be something in there that is something else going to be happening to the world again through these terrorists.
But they can challenge it. They can take it through the courts. That's what they're doing now, Millie. They can sort of, you know, work their way through this and... I mean, that's a right in this country.
Yes, I understand that. But at the same time, we've got a lot of things happening in this world today. And them not being able to do their job in keeping the United States safe is really sounds really just crazy, you know?
Millie, I appreciate your call. I mean, in the political domain, this cuts both ways. You've got Republican candidates saying absolutely that phone should be open. Nate Cardozo, just speak directly to Millie's concern. There are a lot of threats out there. They should just open it.
Well, indeed, there are a lot of threats out there. And frankly, the position that Apple's taken, as General Hayden pointed out, helps Americans resist those threats. You know, Apple has turned over an amazing amount of data about the San Bernardino shooters, who they were talking to and when, the entirety of their iMessage metadata. The FBI already has their text messages, their call history, their email history. All of that is stuff that Apple has assisted the FBI with. The only thing they've said no is no, we won't compromise the security of every American in order to unlock this one phone. And that's what the demand boils down to.
So you've got Loretta Lynch, the U.S. Attorney General, and in testimony today in these hearings in Washington, she's on record saying, you know, she's going to try and open a dialogue to resolve the differences here. James Lewis, do you see a way to negotiate a mutually acceptable outcome here? So far, it has seemed kind of black and white and insoluble. Is there some compromise?
No, this is a fixable problem. It will be difficult, but there is a compromise. And we are balancing risk. There's the cybersecurity risks where what Apple is doing is exactly the right thing. And there are the terrorist risks where what Apple is doing isn't particularly helpful. And somebody, either the courts or the Congress, will have to make a decision about which risk is most important. If we can do that, and if we can get other countries to accept what we're thinking, and they have different points of view about encryption, I think there's a deal here. I mean, this is a manageable problem, but it will take a lot more granularity, a lot more accuracy. Mm-hmm. This is something we can fix.
Do you see, Nate Cardozo, a deal possible and that would respect principle, respect the need for law enforcement, and work?
So the deal that I see is strengthening the ability of the FBI to get what the providers already have. You know, making it quicker to respond to a warrant for iCloud data, for instance. But the mathematicians and the computer scientists tell us that the math doesn't compromise here. You can't make a phone that the FBI can break into and not expose all of us to danger. And, you know, the scientists and the mathematicians who've looked at it are unanimous. There is no dissent there. So to say, we just need the math to compromise, well, we can write a law saying pi is 3, but that doesn't make pi not 3.1415, et cetera.
So what does that mean? A battle all the way to the Supreme Court in that case, if you don't see some negotiated possibility there?
You know, it could go to the Supreme Court. Representative McCall has proposed an encryption commission, which may propose legislation.
With Senator Warner.
It may be resolved at the appellate court level. Who knows? Your guess is as good as mine.
Well, we're going to be watching this a little wiser for all of your insights today, and we're very grateful for them. Nate Cardozo, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, with us today from San Francisco. Thank you, Nate, for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And James Lewis, Senior Fellow, Director of the Strategic Technologies Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. James Lewis in Washington, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thanks.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Be the first to get tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit the like button there. You'll get alerts on upcoming shows in your news feed. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica. With help from Caroline Bechtel and Maeve Pages, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.